I thought about today, based on the story in our text today, I considered having kind of a, survivor-like kind of competition where I was going to have someone come up, or two people come up and just hold a staff or a stick in the air and see who could hold it the longest. Because that's the story we're talking about. I know I would last like 5 minutes, maybe. There was a time in my life, my family, the kids, all grow up watching Survivor competition, the show Survivor, and they do these competitions to try to win immunity. So I thought, well, whoever wins gets immunity. I don't know what immunity from. Church next week, I don't know. What do you get? Or maybe you just get a gallon of peanut butter, because like that's the kind of stuff they give out sometimes because they're so hungry. But I used to think like that I could do well on one of those kind of competition type reality shows. And then I've realized, like, I can't. Like, I'm to the point in life, one, A, I don't want to. B, I would not do well. I know I could not. Like, sometimes I wake up in the morning and feel like I was on Survivor just from my night's sleep. Like, we have one of those, like, little back roller things, and, like, I'm getting out of the bed, like, having to roll my back out. Like, this is common language at my house now. Like, Levi, Daddy, are you rolling out your back? Yes, I'm rolling out my back. Go back to your room before you get in trouble. I'm rolling out my back. And then he'll be like, I need to roll my back out too. And so I didn't think that the competition idea would go that well. I thought like that's where your attention would be. But when we last left God's people in the desert, they were griping about a lack of food and water. Like, we would be better off back in Egypt. Like, no, you would not. You were slaves in Egypt for 400 years. You're working for somebody else. You would not be better off. Does God even care about us? Yes, he cares. He, like, parted the Red Sea and brought you out. But we talked about how, like, we are in the same boat, right? Like, we are the Israelites. When things do not go our way, our tendency is to, like, does God even care or know that I exist and I'm here? I'm better off in this stage of life. And yet, God responds. God responds to the complaining, to the doubt, to the rebellion by sending down a bolt of lightning and annihilating the complainers. No, he doesn't do that. He responds to the complaining and the griping and the whining and the rebellion of the Israelites by pouring out grace, right? By pouring out his provision upon them in spite of that. He gives them this sheer, undeserved, abounding grace. Like, he gives them bread from heaven. They wake up in the morning and they have bread on the ground. Bread from heaven. And like, they do not have to babysit a starter. If you're here last week, you get that reference. If you weren't here, go back and listen. They don't have to like take care of a starter, which actually was like we were talking about the message last week and the whole bread thing. She was like, I'm glad you didn't throw me under the bus, which I guess I'm throwing her under the bus right now. But I'm glad you didn't throw me under the bus and let everybody know that I almost killed our adopted starter baby by not feeding it properly. Like, I don't even know what that means, but they didn't have to babysit a starter or anything like that. They just woke up and there was bread from heaven. In the evenings, God like drops meat into their backyard for them to eat. They're not like sitting in a deer stand when it's still dark 30, hoping some deer would come by. By the way, that's not my game, okay? Like, if you want to say, like, we need to man up Devin some, I'm going to take him deer hunting, I have no desire to sit in a deer stand at 3 o'clock in the morning hoping some sad little animal comes by for you to slaughter. So that might be your thing. It's not my thing, okay? But they're like dropping meat out of the sky. God drops meat out of the sky into their backyard for them. Moses hits a rock and water comes out. They're not like buying water at Walmart. They're not, no water bottles involved, no purifying system, which you need if you live where I live. Because you like turn on the tap water and just smell it. If you out where I live, it's like, we need something to purify this water. I can tell you, I've got like an extra limb growing out of my body from it. But none of that. It's just like water from the rock. And so it's important to remember, though, as we're navigating this, that about this entire event is that God is demonstrating who he is. It's not about the Israelites. He is showing who he is, that he chooses this paltry, podunk, undeserving band of slaves not to show how worthy they are, not to show how moral they are, but to demonstrate how powerful he is, to show how good he is, how faithful he is. And so from the outset, the purpose of this exodus, of this deliverance, has been so that the world might know that he and he alone is God. And so he selects not the strongest, but the weakest people group on earth to display his power to the world. First to the Egyptians, we read about all that, and now to their first outside of Egypt enemies, the Amalekites. Let's pick up in verse 8 of chapter 17. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So again, this is their first kind of military threat outside of Egypt, the Amalekites. And let's just pause and say, who is on the war council of the Amalekites to decide, hey, let's go after Israel? We know from the other parts of Exodus, word has traveled fast what God did. Plagues, part the Red Sea. So let's just pause and think, who's on the war council of this country, Amalek, to say, hey, did you hear about that country that just overcame the most powerful kingdom on earth, the Egyptians, and they never picked up a sword? Their God sent plagues, parted the Red Sea, put the Red Sea back when the most powerful army on the planet was still in the middle of it. Let's pick on them. We need to rethink the war council plans here. But beside the point, the Amalekites decide to attack the Israelites. Now, there's a history here. That's why the Bible, again, is a story. Amalek is the grandson of Esau, of Jacob and Esau. So Jacob and Esau had their whole tension going on. Jacob, of course, the 12 tribes of Israel came out of of Jacob. Esau was his twin brother. We've been through that story. We went through Genesis. And so there's this Jacob-Esau tension. And now we see generations later that it's Esau's descendants that are once again attacking Israel. And so there's a bigger picture at play here. And this goes all the way back before Jacob and Esau to Cain and Abel. It goes back into the garden. It goes back before creation itself. So there's a story at work here. Here's how the Old Testament scholar Doug Stewart describes the Amalekites. He says they organized themselves into a very early national nomadic group that lived partly by attacking other population groups and plundering their wealth. And this is my favorite part of the description of Doug Stewart describing who the Amalekites were. He said they had domesticated the camel. Can we just pause there for a second? They domesticated the camel. I've heard of other animals being domesticated, cats, dogs, those things, but I've never heard of the camel being domesticated. And so in my mind, I'm just what did they teach you how to sit? How do you teach the camel how to sit? I'm thinking roll over. It's a very hard trick to teach the camel. But they domesticated the camel for this purpose, to take advantage of his swiftness. Now, I had to stop there again while I'm reading this, swiftness. It's not what I think about when I think about the camel. When Levi was a couple of years age, he went to the zoo with his siblings and us, and the siblings decided to take Levi on the camel ride. I can tell you there's no swiftness involved. It's just kind of plodding along, right? How long does this thing take around to get around these 20 yards of track? It's been an hour, and we're halfway done here. But they domesticated the camel and took advantage of his swiftness. And then I went on to read, because the camel, I guess when domesticated, can learn how to effectively run up to 45 miles per hour. What? A camel's running 45 miles per hour. That's like Jaguar level camel. And so they domesticated the camel and used it in their surprise attacks upon other people. And I'm thinking, I'm just dropping my sword in utter surprise just to see a camel moving at 45 miles per hour. They're just defenseless. And so the Amalekites perfected the camel attack, and they took advantage. They would again, prove themselves to being these kind of recurring menaces to Israel until, we'll see God's prediction in a few moments, that God promises to eliminate them. And he does by the reign of King Hezekiah, which is another part in Israel's history. Now, a note here, Israel's first enemy, we've seen in the last few weeks, did not come from without. Israel's first enemy came from within. It was their own lack of faith. It was their own disobedience to God. That was their first enemy. But this is their first enemy from without, outside attack upon them. And I have to say, as God followers, like, we have to be aware of both, don't we? That there are enemies that will attack us in our soul. There are from within enemies of our own lack of faith, our disobedience toward God. And then there are outside enemies that we have to be aware of that will attack us and threaten our faith. And so we see that playing out. As a matter of fact, when Moses is reflecting upon this in Deuteronomy chapter 25, when Moses is reflecting upon this attack, he informs us that the Amalekites attacked Israel from behind when the Israelites were faint and weary. And he says that they attacked because they did not fear God. And so the Amalekites positioned themselves as enemies of God and enemies of God's people, which, by the way, is not a wise position to take. And you'll see that played out in the history of this people group, descendants of Esau. So let's see how the story unfolds. Verse 9, so Moses said to, and here's the drum roll, he's rolled out for the first time, and it'll be significant in Israel's history. Moses said to Joshua, this is our first encounter of Joshua in the book of Exodus. He says to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek, and tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So again, we're introduced to Joshua for the first time. If you know anything about Old Testament history and the history of Israel, you know that Joshua is this well-recognized great warrior that's known for his courage and bravery. He succeeds Moses, and he actually is the one who leads Israel into the Promised Land. And so it reminds us again, just by being introduced to Joshua here, that God is writing a bigger story. He's writing a story that's bigger than Moses. We like to make it about Moses, but this story is bigger than Moses. And so we're introduced to Joshua here for the first time. And I love the battle plan that's introduced here. Moses is like, hey, Joshua, choose some men to fight the Amalekites, and I'm going to grab my stick, and I'm going to be standing on top of the hill alongside Aaron and Hur. You know why? Because, again, God is writing a bigger story than Israel. He's writing a bigger story here so that the world might know who is God, the one and only God. God is writing a story bigger than Moses, bigger than Israel, bigger than Joshua. A story whose purpose is so the world might know who God is. And then what follows next is one of the most bizarre, kind of head-scratching stories in the book of Exodus. We've already encountered a couple of those, right? And we said that we're going to give ourselves the freedom to scratch our heads at times and say, what is going on here? And we don't know, and that's okay. And this is one of those moments. This is one of those bizarre stories that we just really don't know. It's kind of a do what story in the Old Testament, and we don't know exactly what's unfolding here. We just know what happened. And so let's read it. We'll pick up again in verse 10. So Joshua did what Moses told him. He fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. And then verse 11, whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. So again, what's going on here? We don't know. All we know is when Moses lifts his hands, Israel wins. When Moses' hands fall, the Amalekites prevail. Hands up, we win. Hands down, Amalek wins. Now, hands up, hands down. Let's do a little survey here. How many of you, one, are roller coaster people? You love roller coasters? Okay, all hands are up. Okay, how many of you that are roller coaster people ride roller coasters with your hands up? Okay, that's what we're talking about. I'm with you. I'm a roller coaster person. We've ridden roller coasters all over the country. We love roller coasters. Bigger, the faster, the better. Now put me on something that spins, I'm out. Because again, I'm old. I'm like, what? Where am I? I just gained 10 years. But roller coasters, up, down, twist, you know, upside down, all that, we're in. I am a hands in the air roller coaster person. I don't want to be holding on and gripping. I mean, like, if somebody's going to fall out, I'm assuming they would have already fallen out and we'd know about it. So I'm thinking I'm safe. So I'm hands in the air. So here's story is hands in the air, we win. Hands down, we lose. And I'm thinking hands in the air, roller coaster people, winners. Hands down, roller coaster people, losers. Are you with me? That's not the application here. Even though I've heard this story applied in similar ways, I have to say. Hands in the air, they're winning. Hands down, winning. You think Moses gave them the ball fake ever? Like, we don't know what's happening. We just know when his hands are in the air, they prevail. Verse 12, we'll continue reading what's going on in the story. Now, again, the picture here, hands in the air, verse 12, but Moses' hands grew weary. Of course they did. They grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. So step one, sit down. You're really tired. And then Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. So Moses gets tired. Of course he does. What is he now? Like almost 100 years old. He's tired. Hands start going down. They hold him up. They sit him down. Hey, we'll prop your hands up. So they pick these guys, Joshua and Hur. They stand on each side and they hold his hands up. Moses grew tired. Of course he did. He's human. He grew tired. And so they developed this plan to help them win. And they do. Verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this. This is important. Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. I told you again, this would happen by the time Hezekiah is ruling and reigning, particularly through the kingships of Saul and David, when they would basically annihilate the Amalekites. And then the last verse of the chapter, and Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So a couple of important things here. One, write this down. Write this down. I'm not telling you to. I'm saying that's what God said. You can write it down if you want to. I saw some of you like, oh, okay, I'm ready. Tell me what's next. God was saying, write this down. That was so funny. You just had to be up here when I said write this down. And I saw like hands to the pen. At least I know you're taking notes. God said, write this down. If you want to write it down too. Because it's going to be recorded for future generations. You kind of see how the Word of God is unfolding here. And then the second thing that happens is Moses builds this altar to express gratitude. That's what altars were. They were acts of gratitude and worship to God for this victory. It's a very common practice in the Old Testament for this to happen. Moses names the altar, the Lord is my banner. This word banner here is the idea of a signal pole. Signal poles were often used as a kind of rallying point for the armies, to regroup them, to recharge the armies. They would have this kind of rallying point to rally the troops together. And the altar we're reading here was this tangible reminder of who God is and what God has done for the people. So God says, don't forget this. You need to pass this down to future generations by writing it down. We talked about the importance of that last week, generational remembering that we pour into generations coming behind us what God has done because we are prone to forget. God says, write this down and keep telling Joshua about it because there's going to be some times he's going to question. Keep telling him. And then Moses says, I'm going to build this tangible reminder. The Lord is my banner, my signal post, so that I might be reminded of what he has done. We have a kind of a similar story from U.S. history. William Beans, who was a friend of U.S. Attorney Francis Scott Key, was taken prisoner by the British during the War of 1812. And Francis Scott Key went to Baltimore and located the ship where his friend, William Beans, was being held captive, and he negotiated his release. However, the terms were that Key and Beans were not allowed to leave until the British bombardment of Fort McHenry. And so they're watching this bombing happen aboard a ship that is 8 miles away and really not knowing how this thing's going to turn out until the next morning. And then you've probably heard the story kind of from that point forward. After this intense day of continual bombing, the British are unable to destroy the Maryland fort, and so they give up. And Francis Scott Key wakes up concerned that the fort has not survived the night, and then the fate of his friend kind of in the balance here. And so he's relieved the next morning when he gets up and he sees this kind of lone American flag that's still flying over Fort McHenry at daybreak. So he knows that the British have failed and that the Americans have maintained the fort. And underneath the red glare, right, of the bombs bursting in air. And so he sits down and he quickly pens a few lines in tribute to what he has witnessed. And his poem later is set to music. By the way, the music was a popular English drinking tune, which is kind of ironic since it was the British and all this. And so it's like, hey, let's put this to an English drinking tune just to kind of rub it in their face even more. And so they put this tune, this poem to music. They renamed it the Star-Spangled Banner. And in 1931, decades later, actually, it was adopted as America's national anthem. And so the Star-Spangled Banner, Oh Glory, whatever term we use to describe it, has kind of served since then as this rallying point for armies, for troops, for Americans to be reminded, right, of what happened and how our freedom was bought and purchased. And so we kind of get the concept here in a different way of what Moses is doing, to remind through this rallying point, the Lord is my banner, the Lord is our flagpole, right, our white flag. We're reminded of what's going on here. So let me make a few observations from this section of Exodus that's a little bizarre, the story is, but it reminds us of some bigger things. And here's how I want to frame this. I want to do it in just kind of three observations as we end today that tie together. The first observation is this. Each story is part of God's story. Each story is a part of God's story. Even bizarre stories are a part of God's story. So here's a word of caution here. As we read and study bizarre stories like this in Scripture, here's our tendency. Our tendency is people who want to understand how God's word applies to our lives. Our tendency is to take bizarre stories like this and to turn them into kind of these moral platitudes or these spiritual cliches or religious life lessons. Let me explain what I mean here. I've heard this story taught a number of different ways. And I have taught it, I've heard it used to teach a number of principles. Let me tell you what I mean, show you what I mean. I've heard this story taught to teach the idea of the importance of putting supportive people around you to hold your hands up when you grow weary. I've heard this story taught with the idea of persevering in prayer, that the idea of Moses holding his hands up was crying out to God, and that God was asking him to persevere in prayer, even if he needed other people. So the hands lifted in prayer idea. I've heard this story taught to encourage those who are involved in the battle of life, that when the soldiers were growing weary, that they could look and see Moses' hands in the air, and that encouraged them in the midst of the war and encouraged them to keep fighting. I've heard this story taught that God will help you in your time of greatest need. Now, are all those principles true? Yes, all of those are biblical truths. Surround yourself with people who will build you up, encourage you. Persevere in prayer. These are all biblical truths, right? Encourage other people. These are biblical principles. God protects us, right? Those are all biblical principles. But none of these principles are what this story is about. None of them are what this story is about. We don't really know what's going on here. We know that when Moses holds his hands up, the Israelites prevail. We know that when his hands go down, the Amalekites prevail. We know that by holding Moses' hands up through these kind of ingenious, creative ways, eventually the Israelites won the battle. And what we know is God overcame his enemy, that God displayed his power over the enemy. You see, our tendency is when there's bizarre stories, we kind of feel like we got to make them into something, don't we? Well, there's a principle of encouragement here. Well, yeah, kind of, but that's not really what this story is about. Should we encourage other people, hold them up in prayer, persevere in prayer? Absolutely. We can go to 100 other texts of the scripture to teach and preach that. It's just not what this story is about. We know Moses serves in this intercessory role on behalf of God's people. Throughout the narrative, his staff serves as this instrument that is used when God displays his righteous judgment and power. His staff was used before Pharaoh to show the power of God. His staff was used at the Red Sea to show the power of God. His staff was used last week to strike the rock and show the provision of God. What seems to be clear in this text is that the battle was won on the hill more than in the trenches. And we are reminded in this story, in this incident, that the battle is the Lord's. Israel prevails not because of their superior military prowess or their leadership expertise or their brilliant war strategy. Israel prevails because Israel's God is superior. Israel wins because their God is the one true God. And their God fights for them. Let me just clear the air here. There is no who's going to win here dilemma going on. There's no, is it going to be Israel? Is it going to be the Amalekites? Is Moses able to keep the staff in the air? There's no like discussion here about who's going to win. You know why? Because God is in absolute control and he brings total victory to his people, for his people, demonstrating his superiority in every way, every single time. Each story is a part of God's story. We also see here kind of the next level of development of that is that each story fits within God's bigger story. Each part is God's story, but each story fits within God's bigger story. It is important when we encounter bizarre stories to remember God's bigger redemptive story. There is something bigger and deeper happening than can Moses keep his staff in the air. Exodus 17 fits within the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus, as we've said from day one, fits within these five other books, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible that God was framing, right? Those five books fit within an Old Testament story of God's redemption. Those books fit within the whole of Scripture. This story fits within the framework of God's constant effort to bring glory to his own name, his constant, continual broadcast of his name throughout the world, that God is the one true God, and his people are this missional, visual reminder to everyone that they encounter that our God is supreme, that he will rule, that he will reign, that he is over all the world. And so these unique, bizarre stories fit within God's bigger story. And throughout this bigger story, God displays his righteous wrath, his judgment against nations who get in the way of his redemptive plan. Have you ever read stories about the annihilation that takes place? And we'll talk about this more. When the enemies of God come face to face with God's enemies and God's just like, annihilate them, destroy them. And we scratch our heads like, is that fair? It doesn't seem right. Why is God just annihilating his creation like this? And we tend to read it just within that context, right? It's like, destroy the Canaanites. Like, why would God destroy them? Well, when you understand the bigger picture of what's at work here, is that God destroys all enemies that stand in the path of his divine redemptive plan. All the way to Satan himself will be annihilated based on God's bigger story. You see, from the opening scene of God's story, there is this cosmic battle that is unfolding. Good versus evil, God versus Satan, light versus darkness. And each time that we read one of these historical war records, we are reminded of this bigger battle that is taking place. One that reaches its climax in a cross and in an empty tomb. That the true enemy of God and his people are not tribes and nations and rulers and kings. That our ultimate enemy is a spiritual one. Our ultimate enemy is a spiritual enemy. By the way, one who has already been defeated. You remember what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6? We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We wrestle against spiritual forces in heavenly places. That Satan is real. That his demons are real. That spiritual warfare is real. And that you are in a spiritual battle every single day of your life. And that's why Paul says, armor up. Armor up so that you can withstand the schemes and the attacks of the spiritual enemy. And here's why. Because of spiritual warfare. Now, we use that term. We use that term, spiritual warfare. And what I've discovered is there's kind of two categories of people when you hear that term. There's spiritual warfare, and there's the people that read lots of books about spiritual warfare, and they're like, you're right. And they tend to find Satan behind every corner, right? I had a flat tire this morning. Like, Satan almost took me down. My tire went flat. I didn't put enough, I ran out of gas. Satan, man, he was after me. I ran out of gas this morning. No, it wasn't Satan. Like, you just forgot to put gas in your tank. But they tend to find, like, Satan behind every corner. And then what I've discovered, most people are kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, aren't we? We hear that term spiritual warfare and we just zone out. We tune out. It's like, well, that's for people that read like books about Revelation and read about, the spiritual battles taking place. And we tend to tune all that out. Let me break down for you what that means. We're not talking about like casting demons out of people, Rosemary's Baby, head spinning around kind of stuff. For the average believer, we're talking about spiritual warfare. You see, most often spiritual warfare is waged in barely perceptible ways. Here's where it's waged. In the friendships that I maintain. The fear and anxiety and worry that constantly grips my heart. How I treat my spouse. How I parent my kids. This kind of gravitational pull that I have towards self-centeredness. Having things my way. Ruling and reigning my own heart. Taking God's gifts of grace and turning them into my own idols. Making it about the gift and not the giver, as we talked about last week. Neglecting time with God in exchange for time with the trivial. That's where spiritual warfare happens. It is this constant fight for control of my soul. The front lines of spiritual warfare is not the head spinning around, cast the demon out. The front lines of spiritual warfare is in my everyday life. Who has control of my soul? Who's sitting on the throne of my heart? The enemy is not a fool. He's not going to like send demons at you and be like freaking you out about stuff. It's in subtle ways, isn't it? Because if he can entice you and deceive you in the subtle, he doesn't have to worry about the extraordinary. It's going to happen in the ordinary trenches of life, not the extraordinary fringes of life. That's why Paul says, armor up. Because it's a daily battle. And to win these daily battles, we face them within the context of this bigger cosmic battle. Good and evil, God and Satan, light and darkness, this cosmic battle that is happening, of which the winner has already been crowned. He's already been crowned King of Kings, Lord of Lords. There is no question how this bigger battle ends. We do not believe in some type of spiritual dualism where we're kind of like, who's going to win, good or bad, evil or righteousness, like, who's going to win? There's an outcome hanging in the balance. We already know how this thing plays out. The victor has been declared. He has been crowned. He has already overcome. And even if you venture into those scary terrains of those last scenes of the Bible in the book of Revelation, where few people dare to tread, right? Even if you venture over into those last scenes where it all plays out, as bizarre and difficult as those texts are to interpret, one thing is clear. And that is how this whole thing ends. I like in the book of Revelation how in the pinnacle battle at the end of time, that basically when you read it, Jesus simply steps onto the scene and declares who he is. By the way, which goes all the way back to Exodus, when he says he is the great I am, that he basically steps onto the scene and declares, I am. And his enemies are annihilated. With a spoken word. There's no doubt how this thing plays out. The bigger battle has already been fought and won on a hillside called Calvary. The battle is the Lord's, and we live in that victory. Every day we suit up, we armor up, but we do not live with uncertainty and fear. We live with the good news of the gospel. Jesus triumphed over Satan. He's already won the battle for us. Which leads us into this final observation from this section. It ties into this. Each story is a part of God's story. Each story is a part of God's bigger story. And each story fits within the, emphasis on the, ultimate story. Once again, we see Moses in this kind of mediator role in the story. He intercedes on behalf of the people of God. But Moses is simply pointing forward to a greater mediator. A mediator, Paul says in 1 Timothy, that is the only one qualified to stand between us and God. That Moses is pointing forward to Jesus Christ, our true intercessor. That Jesus is the ultimate mediator because he is both fully God and fully man. And for that reason, Jesus is a greater warrior than Joshua. Jesus is a greater interceder than Moses because Jesus had his arms stretched out on a cross, on a hillside, on our behalf. And he won the ultimate battle over sin, over death, over hell, over the grave, so that he does not have to have his hands raised by anyone. He does not grow tired. He does not grow weary. There is no one who has to come alongside Jesus and say, let's prop you up to see this thing through. He is tireless in his interceding on our behalf. And I want to tell you, in the case of Devin, it's a good thing that he's tireless because I need him. Every day, every moment. I need him interceding on my behalf. The writer of the book of Hebrews in chapter 7 says, he always lives to intercede on our behalf. Paul says in Romans 8:34, no one is able to condemn us. You know why? Paul says, no one condemns us because Jesus is at the right hand of the Father interceding for us. We fight the good fight of faith, and he intercedes. I love that image that no one condemns us because Jesus is at the right hand of the Father, tirelessly interceding on our behalf. No one can bring accusations against Devin to the Father. You know why? Because Jesus is there. He's interceding on my behalf. The enemy may want to come and say, did you know this about Devin? Did you see this? You see what he did? No one knows this. Let's peel these things out. Let's roll these things out. Jesus intercedes on my behalf. I am here to intercede on his behalf, not on how moral he is, but because I lived in perfect obedience. I stretched my hands out and died so that he might live. No one condemns as he intercedes on our behalf. Jesus is also our banner, isn't he? He's like our signal post. Isaiah would talk about this in chapter 11 when he says the Messiah will stand as a banner for all peoples, that the nations will seek him and his resting place will be glorious, that he is our banner, that Jesus is our banner, that he is our signal post, that he is the signal pole, and that we don't build altars today and name them things. You know why? Because we have an altar. We have a signal post. It is an empty tomb. Like, that's the memorial that we have. The tomb is empty. God's people rally to him and for him from every nation on the planet. And it is through his victory that we are unified and encouraged and sent on mission to the world. We have victory because of his victory. And it is through his victory that we live out our victory in the trenches of everyday life. We armor up because the victory has been won. Our stories fit within the story, his story. So let me give you some good news. As bizarre as your story might be, as unusual as your story is, as ordinary as your story might appear, as dark as your story may seem, as peculiar as your life journey may appear, or as mundane and everyday as your story seems, I want to tell you, God is writing a bigger story. He is writing the story, the only story with a true, happily ever after ending. And our stories, they fit within his story. So, let's raise our banners high. Let's proclaim his name loudly. Because that's what he's doing, right? That he will proclaim and broadcast his name to all the world for all of history. That he is the one and only true God. And so what that means for you, if you're a follower of Jesus, no one condemns us. No one condemns us because he is interceding on our behalf.